We're very glad to have a parking problem. We have already selected among the bids we received the firm we'd like to build the next one, the same firm that built this one and did it so well for us. The only problem is we need $23,000. I would suggest that if you want to memorialize somebody, you could do it, although a parking lot is not the most romantic memorial gift, I suppose, unless you have known somebody who likes to park. If you do, we will accept your check and we will put a plaque out there in the lot. If you have not been here before or lately, we're in the midst of a group of sermons on what the medieval church called the seven deadly sins. This is the day for the fourth one, envy, which, unlike some of the others, is not hard to define. It is that gut-wrenching resentment and unhappiness over the fact that someone else has what we want and what we obviously deserve more than the one who has it. It is a widespread disease. I doubt if any one of us in this room has been able to come this far without having felt the sting and bite of envy. Most of us come down with this form of jealousy intermittently, but we all know a few people who, on a permanent basis, simply cannot bear to see other people happy. They are suspicious of anyone who laughs a lot. They wither at the very sight of joy. They hate all excellence which they cannot reach. They cannot get a moment's peace from the corrosive acid that destroys from within their peace of mind. It was of such people that Francis Bacon said a long time ago, "Envy has no holidays. It walks the street and cannot keep at home." I've said to envious people, "Why not look more closely at your own blessings and be grateful, even a little embarrassed, at how much more fortunate you are right now than most people?" But the advice is often wasted. Envy cannot keep at home. It is the nature of it to run about until it finds something to feed on and make its owner sick. It has a certain look about it, which you can recognize. An old 17th century clergyman named Thomas Fuller had seen that look, and this is how he describes it. "An envious man is a squint-eyed fool." I took the title of this sermon from him when I realized that I had actually seen people look at other people, envying their fame or fortune or good looks, and physically narrow their eyes a little, squinting, contracting their eyes in the very same moment that they were contracting their heart. There are other reasons, of course, but envy is one of the causes of that irrational dislike we sometimes feel for other people. The classic example in literature is a man named Iago in a play of Shakespeare's who bitterly hates a man named Cassio, who has never done him any harm at all. In a moment of scalding honesty, Iago explains his hatred. He hath a daily beauty in his life that makes me ugly. That's all. Cassio's gentle, courteous life was a constant judgment on Iago's scheming, suspicious nature. Iago was so envious of a life lovelier than his own that he could not rest until he had destroyed it. You can sometimes find that feeling at work, in a business office, in a social group, in a classroom, in a church, any place with people. It has happened a million times, which is why the church declared centuries ago that envy is a cardinal sin, ruinous and deadly. If that's true, we can justify trying this morning to understand it, to learn what lies behind it, to learn whether there are any ways we can control it. As to cause, there is first the simple fact of inequality. All men are not created equal, except in some ideal sense of the rights they deserve. We're certainly not equal in opportunities or in native endowments. Here is a man genetically blessed from birth with good looks and a high energy level. There is another man crippled by birth with poor health, an unattractive demeanor. One woman is both intelligent and beautiful in a world where looks and wit win all kinds of advantages. Her sister has neither of those. I've spent a happy lifetime reading all kinds of literature, secular and sacred. But there is a girl who sits in my class each week who has never read anything, never seen anything, because somebody provided too much oxygen when she was born, an accident, a moment of ignorance, and she walks in darkness the rest of her life. It must be hard for her not to envy the rest of us, looking at one another's faces, laughing at things she cannot see. I would suppose that sometimes alone she has a moment of bitterness. Well, differences like that are easy enough to notice and to become bitter about, but envy is manufactured as well. Modern advertising is dedicated much of the time to reminding us that we should covet what we do not have. If you do not own a Continental Mark IV, how can you expect a beautiful and sophisticated woman in a slinky white gown to bless your life? Want to make your next door neighbor's eyes turn green with envy, the ad asks? Then buy a fur coat from somewhere. Watch an evening of television and keep a running count of the ads that appeal overtly to envy, to dissatisfaction, and you begin to understand part of the malaise we create in American life. Some people, of course, feel this is a good idea. Envy, they tell us, is the motivating force behind all social and economic movement. If no one envied, no one would move up. Maybe so. Envy certainly thrives on the competitive spirit, on the devotion we give to those who win. And maybe this is why we're not as creative and original as we'd like to be, because envy is not creative. It's only imitative. The envious young man must get on the merry-go-round must buy the right car, must own the fashionable house in the right part of town. Keeping up is the game envy plays. It cannot find its own lifestyle. It must borrow someone else's. If you want the Rolls Royce because that marvelous engineering fulfills your life and the sacrifice is worth it, that's honest. And it may be good. But if you want it to prove something, to make a competitor envious, then it's a paltry ambition. Not only are we unequal, and the differences among us exploited, but we find that what really hurts is that often there's not a whole lot we can do about it. One student works like a short order cook and gets a B minus. Beside him sits a fellow student who without the least straining gets straight A's. I see it every week, and I see some B minus students whose happiness is ruined simply because life was more generous to somebody else. They don't look at the D and F students, pity them, and rejoice. They look at the A students, envy them, and get bitter. All this makes the sin of envy sound like the sin of the have-nots against the haves, which is how it has often been defined, but it's not as simple as that. People at the top may be sick with envy quite as much as those at the bottom. The classic example of that in the literature of the Bible is the first king of Israel, a tall, moody fellow named Saul. Saul was happy until a young man named David became a hero in his army. David, with his marvelous good looks and the charisma popping out all over him, so great a warrior that the people hailed him as a hero, and the women sang in the streets that while Saul had slain thousands of the enemy, David had slain tens of thousands. And up in the palace window, watching the parade in David's honor, Saul turned green. Envy swelled in his throat until he choked on it, and then it turned into violent hatred. He tried to kill David more than once and failed. He sacrificed his own daughter to get rid of his rival. Nothing worked. And Saul's life rotted in the smell of sour grapes. Only one thing would have worked. He might have sat down one day and said quietly to himself, "All right, Saul, you're simply up against a better man. After all, there are better men in this world, and you've run into one of them. David has some qualities you don't have. Learn to live with that and be pleased to do the best you can." That might have done the trick, but Saul couldn't pull it off. And from that day on, envy drove him mad and finally destroyed his life. It might help if we knew the beginning symptoms of this illness so we could recognize it. First of all, it's a born rationalizer. It never can say something like this: "Well, my rival deserves the prize he got. He worked hard." Instead, it says, "Boy, did he have connections." Or it says, "Well, you can see how it goes with the ones who are lucky." Envy cannot bear to acknowledge merit in those who win where it has failed. If that isn't soothing enough, it begins the great leveling job. What it can't have, it belittles. "I wouldn't have that job. If it were the last one on earth, he'll be sorry he got the promotion. Or it says, well, she got him, and I'll guarantee she'll be sick of her bargain within a year. When I want something, it's priceless. When I can't have it, and someone else gets it, it turns into trash. So envy works. In love, envy is cruel, jealous, and possessive. My friend, it says, must have no interests outside me. My partner must be wholly wrapped up in me. If we can't be happy together, we'll be unhappy together, but there must be no escape into pleasures I can't share. If my husband's work means more to him than I do, I'll see him ruined rather than preoccupied. If my wife is so hopeless as to enjoy Beethoven or ballet or anything else I don't appreciate, I'll so nag and insult her that she'll give them up for the sake of peace. Envy operates by questioning motives. If someone does a good thing, apparently generous and unselfish, and therefore a reminder of how stingy and mean I am, I have to find a way to diminish the deed. So I say, what's he trying to pull? If a friend is kinder than we can account for, we ask, what do you suppose she wants? A church member with half our income gives twice as much as we do, and we tell ourselves there has to be an ulterior and selfish motive. He may never know it, of course, that we are thinking things like that. And this is why envy almost always hurts most the people who harbor it. The Greeks had a story to illustrate that. They told of a boy who so distinguished himself in the public games that a statue was raised to him and dedicated in his honor. But this so inflamed the envy of one of his rivals that the rival went out one night under cover of darkness to destroy the statue. It was enormously heavy, and it took him most of the night to move it from its pedestal, but he finally made it. He was found the next morning caught under it, crushed to death when it fell on him. Parable of a million lives. But there are remedies which have worked for some people and may for us. One is to accept ourselves and our gifts, however modest, and make the best of them without worry over somebody else's greater gifts. I think Emerson can help us a little. There is a time, he says, in every man's education when he arrives at the conviction that envy is ignorance, that imitation is suicide, that he must take himself for better or worse as his portion, that though the wide universe is full of good, no kernel of nourishing corn can come to him but through his own toil, bestowed upon that plot of ground which is given him to till. That's one way to conquer envy. The other is to train yourself to think more of the work to be done than the status of the worker. John the Baptist was at the height of his popularity when Jesus came along, but from that moment, John's influence waned. It was not only that the crowds left him to follow Jesus, the best of his own disciples went along with them. Another man might have been embittered. So far as we can learn, John wasn't. He simply said, He must increase and I must decrease. He thought that was how the purposes of God could best be served. Quite a man. And since I'd like to end it by being just as practical as I can, please consider this remedy. Before we go out in the morning to do some business in the world, we might stop somewhere for a moment and say, in our own kind of prayer, today I shall be among people who are less capable than I am. Help me not to take advantage of them or to exult in my superiority. But I shall also be among people who in certain ways are stronger and better than I am. Help me not to envy them or poison with bitterness and hate our relationship, but to be content and do what I can as well as I can at peace with myself. That may be hard to remember and even hard to say, but it would save us from envy. And believe me, there's a lot of envy in this world. If you want to know how true that is, ask yourself, when you're putting somebody down, crudely or cleverly, am I doing this simply because I'm jealous? It will be surprising how often the answer is yes.